like the slide says, this is about location privacy for our smartphone apps. This is joint work with Venkat Padmanabhan and Mudit Jain at MSR India. So, okay, in this crowd, I don't need to motivate the problem. We all know, we all have smartphones, it's been tracked, everyone knows exactly where we are. But just to put numbers to the whole thing, folks last year at the last OSDI said, you know, they looked at popular Android applications, about half of them take your location, send it out over the network. Before I continue, so that looks like a latitude, longitude. How many of you would care to guess where in San Jose this is? Here? How many say here? Great. Fair number. Thank you for those of you who raised your hands, and those who don't know where this is and didn't raise your hand, you just underscore my point. This is actually the Elmwood Correctional Facility, the big prison just a couple of minutes north of here. But I mean, that sort of makes my point, right? That application developers, they get their two latitude, longitude. What do they do with it on the phone? They have no idea. So they have to send it to the cloud to actually make any sense of it, right? So application developers are not the problem. We are the problem. I don't mean Microsoft, but actually I do. I also mean Google and Apple along with it. Anyone who is in the business of doing these location-based APIs has given application developers an extremely hard abstraction to use. And so they go ahead and contact third-party libraries and third-party cloud services. So what's the solution to this, right? We have a privacy problem. App developers are clearly not in a position to actually solve it. How do we solve it, right? It's sort of like saying we gave app developers assembly and we are now blaming them for writing buggy code. The solution isn't to teach them how to write better code. The solution is to give them C or Java or Python or what have you, right? So how do we change the level of abstraction that app developers use to build the location-based applications so that we can actually make their lives easier and we can give privacy to users, right? So that's essentially the approach that we've been taking. So let's look at technically what this means. So this is what happens today. Your phone has a GPS, sends a location to the OS. OS happily sends it to the app whenever it queries it. And at that point, the app basically takes it off to the internet, goes, does whatever it wants to do with it. So we say, OK, if your OS releases control of your location, apps will obviously use third-party libraries. Whether or not they want to leak users' privacy, they'll just use it and go off to the cloud, right? So the OS has no more control over this piece of private information about you. So if you really want to change the privacy story, then you have to flip the arrows here, right? Instead of giving the location willy-nilly to applications, how about we ask the application to express its intent to the OS, right? What exactly is it that you're trying to do with my location, right? And then the platform somehow combines this intent with the location and facilitates providing this location-based service. And when you have the platform doing it, you have a much stronger control over where data is going, what type of data is being handled, and the platform can, of course, include the OS, certainly, but also a cloud component that can be designed to preserve user privacy, right? So that's sort of the approach that we're going to take. We're going to have the application tell the OS what it wants to do with the location, and the OS is then going to combine everything together, do something useful with it. Now, then the big question becomes, well, there's a large number of location-based applications. How do you design an API or abstraction that's simple and general enough to support all these large things while allowing you to actually be able to implement it, right? So that's sort of what we started looking at, and we came up with, the other part is if you have a cloud, then of course you can do a lot more cool stuff with other users, but yeah. So we came up with this API based on triggers and callbacks. So those of you who have taken an introductory databases course, remember that this is nothing new. Right, you install some sort of a triggers in a database. When you get the appropriate data, the triggers fire, some stuff happens. We said, okay, can we take that to the location setting? Can we use location-based triggers as the abstraction for building all applications that we could think of? So here's sort of the example of what a trigger would look like. You know, say the application says, okay, whenever I'm within five blocks from wherever Bob is, I don't know where Bob is, I don't know who Bob is, but wherever he is, if I'm within five blocks from him, let me know, right? We can actually support something like this. Or the application can, at a very high level, say, just ping me whenever the user's at any grocery store, right? It doesn't have to deal with latitude, longitude. It doesn't have to deal with address. It just says, I just need a grocery store. Just let me know whenever the user gets there, right? So that would be a very cool abstraction to support. App developers would be able to write these sort of queries in the app without having to go to the cloud and the platform would be able to actually deliver this. Right? So then the question is, what is the platform support that you need in order to provide this abstraction, and how do you do it in a privacy-preserving manner? So that brings me to what we mean by privacy. So Rich wants to talk, he talked about differential privacy, and that's fantastic when you're talking about aggregate queries, right? Because you want to compute something over a large set of users, doesn't matter if the final answer is just slightly off a little bit. But that really doesn't apply, the whole model doesn't apply to fine-grained personalization. What differential privacy says is, if you take one of these records out of your database, your result doesn't change a lot. But if you're trying to do something like personalized advertising through this thing, well, your results should better change if the advertiser exists or doesn't exist, right? So you can't use that model for doing privacy in this sort of setting. So we said, okay, what other options are there? There's another definition of privacy called unlinkability. This is, again, an old definition, 10 years old, where it says it's not the individual data items that are private, it's the linkage between the data items. So being here in San Jose, if someone can figure out that I am looking for bail bonds, then that's private information. If someone can figure out that, oh, someone is looking for bail bonds, I don't know who, well, that could be a lot of people, and so that's not considered private. Or if someone figures out that Psychot is looking for something, but they don't know what, that's also not private information. I could be looking for anything, right? So that's sort of the intuition behind unlinkability that says that when you can link pieces of information is when you violate privacy. So let's do the location-based advertising example. Right. So we have some advertiser. Here we have the Zigzag Bail Bond Company, which actually exists. It's here on North 2nd Street. They have an ad that they want to reach users that are looking for bail bonds. Okay. So as an advertiser or an application that the advertiser is using, this is literally the three lines of code that they need to write. Right. They have a record, an item, which is themselves. So it's a create item Zigzag. You add an attribute to it, which is what people are looking for, bail bonds. And then there's this special function, add location attribute, that adds an attribute, but tags it as something special, and we'll see how that comes in useful later. It says add location attribute, and you give it an address. Right? You're not giving it a latitude, longitude, the advertiser has his business address, he just puts it in, and that's all that happens. Right? Now, I as a user come into the system, I'm looking for bail bonds, my application is going to create a trigger. So a trigger is, think of it as a standing query. I create a trigger, and I give it a callback. So whenever this query gets matched, something is going to fire, and my application will wake up, and it can then take appropriate action. So again, the same functions. You create a trigger, we give it a callback, and you add two things. You add the attribute that you're looking for, bail bonds, and this can be anything opaque. I'm just using strings here. And the second one is the interesting part, add location attribute. And it says, I'm looking for this special string, current location plus 5 blocks. Okay, so here, the application doesn't need to know what my current latitude, longitude position is. All it says is I'm just looking for something within 5 blocks of here, wherever here is. And this is special syntax that the OS can then recognize and then combine with the location data that it is getting from the GPS hardware and then plug the rest of it into the system. The other parameter that you see off to the right there is, it says true. What it basically represents is whether the OS is allowed to or expected to automatically update this location. So because we now have this higher level of abstraction where the OS can actually know that this is a location attribute, the OS can say, okay, you know what? As the user moves around, I will automatically update the value of current location. I won't bother you. I won't wake you up every time the user moves. I will just do it for you. Okay. So now once you have this sort of a API and abstraction for app developers, let's see what the backend platform looks like that will deliver this matching primitive that we're talking about. So we have the advertiser on the left and my record, the trigger on the right. Now we're gonna rely on the cloud, of course, and we're gonna rely on two parties. And the protocol is going to be sort of similar to similar in setup to what Richwan said, or if you're aware of the Privet work from last year, we're going to have two parties that we'll assume to be non-colluding. While, I mean, so the way to think about this is that the guy on the right, the left, the matcher, has a lot of, will require a lot of brains, so that might be Google or Microsoft or what have you. The guy on the right will be a very simple party, and it could be implemented by VeriSign, EFF, what have you. Or they could even be like branches of the same company as long as there's some sort of transparent mechanism to make sure that the two branches are not colluding. Anyway, so we're going to have these two parties, and the first thing that we are going to do once these triggers and items are created, it will create state in the cloud. So I'll walk you through how this state is created, and then I'll walk you through how we actually match the matching pairs. So we'll start with the guys on the bottom. First, Zigzag and Bailbond. Right, so we'll take that pair. Now, as it stands right now, that would violate privacy because it's two things, the username and a user attribute that are right there sitting next to each other, and that violates privacy by our definition. What we're going to do is first encrypt the second attribute with the matcher's public key. So we only have two public keys in the system, matcher, combiner, we don't have a key distribution problem. We're going to encrypt it once with the matcher's private key, and then that encrypted thing, we're going to encrypt it a second time with the combiner's public key. Okay, so this is a double encrypted piece of data. We're going to send this message over to the matcher. Now, the matcher, of course, can't decrypt the encryption because the outer encryption is with the combiner's public key. So the matcher creates a pseudonym, U1, for this particular user, Zigzag, replaces the user's identity in the message with this U1, sends it off to the combiner. The combiner at this point doesn't know that this came from Zigzag. The combiner sees the encrypted chunk. He can decrypt the outer layer, but he still can't get to the core attribute because the inner thing is encrypted by the matcher's public key. So the combiner creates a second pseudonym, but it's actually sort of, think of it as a row ID or record ID, R1, replaces it in the message, takes away the outer layer of encryption, sends it back to the matcher. Now at this point, we assume that there's enough normal traffic that's going between the combiner or matcher, either natural traffic, or if there's not enough natural traffic, you just add noise, so that the entire point is that the second message that came to the matcher can't correlate it with the first message that it sent out. As long as you have enough traffic flowing through the system or noise in the system, then you can provide this sort of a mix type guarantee. So now at this point, the matcher sees, okay, I have some random R1 with an encrypted attribute. Now that I can decrypt because it's encrypted with my key. Decrypts it, figures out it's Bailbond, says, okay, well, I'm going to store this. So now at this point, what you'll notice is that the matcher, so the private aspect was Zigzag and Bailbonds, right? The two things about a particular thing that we don't want to be linked. Here, the matcher, with just the matcher's data, cannot link U1 to R1, cannot link Zigzag to Bailbonds. On the combiner side, the combiner is holding on to the linkage, but it doesn't have the plain text, so it doesn't know about Zigzag or Bailbonds. Okay, and as long as the two of them don't collude, the neither of them learn the private part that we're trying to protect. So the same way, I'm going to put in the address, the North 2nd Street, that's going to add a second row at the combiner, R2, and it's going to add a second row here at the matcher for that address. Same thing for my Bailbond query. It's going to add a third row for user 2 at the combiner, and R3 is going to show up next to Bailbonds. So now comes the interesting location part, right? So I want to now put this query, current location plus 5 blocks, into the cloud. Now, my phone, my OS, has my current location. So that it can replace right then and there. So current location becomes some latitude, longitude in the OS. It's not happening inside the app, it's happening in the OS, plus 5 blocks. But the phone, the OS, does not have the smarts to figure out what 5 blocks means. 5 blocks in New York means something different than 5 blocks in the Bay Area, right? So, but that's fine, because the cloud does have this capability, but then how do you get this message to the cloud so that you can exercise this capability? Right, so we do the exact same thing that I mentioned before. We double encrypt this, send it over to the matcher, matcher replaces it with the pseudonym, sends it to the combiner, combiner adds a record entry, it comes here, and this guy decrypts it. Now here's the actual very cool bit. The matcher has the original attribute in plain text, so it can apply as much smarts as it wants to actually make sense of this. In this particular case, it can figure out, oh, that's the latitude, longitude, geocodes it to some city, figures out the block size, and can then figure out that this actually matches this North 2nd Street entry that it already has. Right, now this is very cool because a lot of people who have been trying to do location privacy have either done it by adding noise, which makes the answers imprecise, which doesn't help, or they have done it by encrypting various things, at which point you can only do perfect matches. Here, because we are able to handle attributes in plain text, we can actually do really, really cool matching. We can do spelling correction, we can do language translation, we can do these location replacement stuff at a very high level. Okay, cool, great. So now we have all this state. Last part is, how do we actually find a match? I was looking for a bail bond shop. So I say, okay, find a match for me. I send my username over. Matcher says, okay, well, I don't know what you're looking for. I can't link any of my attributes with your name, but all I know is you are user U2. I'm going to send that over to the combiner. Combiner says, well, I don't know who this user U2 is, but all I do know is that he registered attributes R3 and R4. I'm going to ask the matcher for R3. Again, we use that assumption that there's enough natural traffic or noisy traffic flowing through so that the matcher can't correlate it with the second message. He gets a query for R3, says, oh, R3 matches R1. I don't know whoever you're querying this for, but R3 matches R1. At this point, the combiner concludes that these two attributes for these two users, U1 R1 and U2 R3, match with each other. Same thing happens with the R4 attribute. R4 goes across, R2 comes back, figures out that those two match. Now, one cool thing to note here is that we don't use any crypto encryption, decryption here in this phase of the matching. The crypto was only at the very initial phase where we had that two double encrypted stuff. We decrypted it once, that's it. After that, the system runs without any crypto. So that really helps our scalability story. Okay, so at this point, the combiner can claim that U1 and U2 have matched because all their attributes are matching to each other, but doesn't know why they matched or who U1 and U2 are. Sends it over to the matcher. Matcher says, well, okay, I don't know why you guys matched, but you clearly matched. Figures out that this is Cycuthan zigzag. Sends this information back to the phone. Now, if you're worried about the matcher finding out this match between Cycuthan zigzag, there's actually an extension in the paper that uses slightly more crypto to even obscure that from the matcher. Okay, so what did we get from this whole system? One was that we got matching based on plain text, which allows us to do lots of cool stuff in the cloud, location, spelling correction, translation, as I mentioned, other semantic transformations. And the second thing that we got is by increasing the level of abstraction, the OS can now actively participate in all these location-based applications. It can tell the application, you can go to sleep, I will auto-update everything, I will let you know where you are near some place that makes sense to you as an application, right? And that's pretty cool. And we actually end up getting some energy savings on phone apps, but we didn't have space in the paper to talk about that. Okay, so then the question is, what applications can you write to this? So we said, okay, there are tons of applications. Let's look at classes of applications and see if we can address those classes. So we went through the Android marketplace. We picked out the top, 50-odd applications. We looked at how they use the location thing. Turns out there are roughly 6 classes of location applications. The 4 are obviously very, very popular. There's advertising, content tagging photos with location, search. So once you have tagged content, you want to find content that's close to you, location-based recommendations. And those are exactly the example that I explained before. You take some content, you tag it with location, you put it in, you use these triggers to retrieve them back. You can do advertising, you can do search, all that. The two that are sort of special are social networking and navigation. Right? So we said, okay, let's see if we can use our abstraction to actually implement these two applications, and turns out that we can, and we can actually make them better in some sense. So here's a very quick intuition on how we did the social networking application. You insert an item corresponding to you. You take this tag, me:cycle, that's just a string. You encrypt it with your, say, key that you share with your friends, and you put it in. So the cloud actually doesn't even know that the string there is Cycuthan, it's just some opaque string. You take, say, a key of your friend, Rob, encrypted with his key that you know as his friend, put that in. So you create this item, right? Now, Rob, on his phone, creates a corresponding trigger. When he wants to find you, he says, okay, I'm looking for anyone who has put in this particular encrypted junk, which he can compute because he has your profile key, and you have the same location-based stuff that I talked about earlier. So now you can do this looped style of location-based social networks where people can be moving around, and they'll get alerts when they're within, say, 5 blocks of each other. But the cool thing here is that the social network storage essentially is being provided by this cloud service. The cloud service actually doesn't know who your friend list is. So all that stuff stays on your phone. The encrypted stuff lives in the cloud, and so you actually have a truly private mobile social network. So that's cool. How do you do friends of friends? Where Bob, who's Rob's friend, puts in a trigger for other friends of Rob so the orange part matches the orange part in my item, and so you can still do friends of friends. We can show how you can do groups and so on. Navigation, real quick. How do we do navigation? We use that mechanism that allows us to do spelling correction and translation because everything's in the plane to actually do navigation. So the location attribute that we put into the cloud says, find me, okay, so the attribute is current location to zigzag. So that's a query for directions, let's say. The phone replaces that with my current location, IP, my lat long with in the attribute, sends it over to the cloud. Now in the cloud, we take the actual directions. We compute the directions and we replace it with the string turn left, right? From your current location to zigzag, the first thing you need to do is turn left, let's say. At the same time, we also register these triggers for turn left, turn right, turn around, so that when this thing eventually in the cloud gets computed to turn left, you end up with one of these triggers firing, and then you play out that sound to the user, right? When your location changes again, the attribute changes, the cloud recomputes the next step, turn right, the next trigger fires. So basically what ends up happening in the navigation app is that as you move from place to place, at every step, the next waypoint or the next direction ends up triggering in your app, and the app can actually show you the directions to that place. So what we ended up doing was we took all the classes of location-based applications, and we were actually able to implement it on this triggers and matching-based API, which I think was pretty cool. So then we said, okay, great, so that all that works. Are we actually private? So we said, let's try using these model checkers and theorem prover and see if we can actually model this protocol that we have in a formal way and see if we can get proofs about this. And turns out that we could. We had to think a bit hard about how to model the various things we were interested in. Unlinkability as privacy, that's something that took a little bit of thought getting to. How to model the adversary, the honest but curious adversary, just like Rishwan used. And the data store in this particular tool called ProVerif, but we were actually able to do it. And at the end of the day, we found proofs, or ProVerif gave us proofs that said that indeed in our protocol, a user cannot be linked with an attribute about the user, a user's multiple attributes cannot be linked together, and that in the extension version of Koi, that the matched users cannot be linked together. So that was kind of cool. Oh, by the way, the proofs that this particular tool gives us are sound but not complete. So what that means is that if it says there's a proof for it, that's actually true. It basically brute forces the entire proof space and it gives you a correct answer. If it says that there's no proof for it, that might be because it found a false attack, so then the human has to go in and check whether it's a false attack or a real attack. In all these cases, we found sound concrete proofs about it. Rarely ProVerif doesn't terminate, but we didn't come into the encounter that for these proofs. Okay, so one question that a bunch of you might be having is, okay, how do we deal with malicious apps? The answer is, well, at some level we don't. We basically say that malicious apps at the end of the day might be able to do a lot more stuff, but we can mitigate the threat because now the OS is in the middle. It can do things that it could otherwise not. It can filter the triggers because it knows what the trigger this malicious app is trying to set, or it can rate limit the triggers and callbacks so that your app cannot install 1,000 or 1,000,000 triggers and figure out how you're walking based on very fine-grained information. So we can do all that rate limiting, we can do all that across users, across multiple users, and we can make it much harder for malicious apps to get any information out. And the question might come up about, you know, well, how do you deal with Sybils? Well, it turns out that Apple does it for us. They charge you $100 for each app that you want to put up under a different ID and under a different credit card. So, you know, there's an economic burden to actually sending these apps out. So we actually implemented this. We have a cloud service running on Azure, which is Microsoft version of EC2. It supports HTML5 mobile browsers, iPhones, standard smartphones, C# bindings. It scales actually pretty well. I'm not going to talk about the scalability numbers in the talk. The details are in the paper. But because we use crypto extremely sparingly, it actually scales to whatever our transport library could actually support. On the combiner side, it's architected so you can bring your own combiner. So if you trust EFF and EFF has a combiner, you can use that. Or if you don't trust EFF, you can write your own combiner, put it on EC2, and hook it up to the service. Or if you're lazy, you can use our combiner, at which point all the privacy guarantees go for a toss. So, how long do I have left? Okay, excellent. So that's where I want to at least stop for now and then take more discussion questions. But at the end of the day, the entire just get lat long API for phones is just a privacy nightmare. And we should be able to do better. And what the right abstraction is, I don't know. We presented one. we certainly think it's better than the existing API in terms of providing privacy, in terms of helping application developers you make use of this location stuff in a much more easy way. But that's of course up for debate. And final point is Proverse is a very cool tool. It saved me from having to write proofs. Yep, thank you.
Hi, Fitz Nolan, Yale University. Two questions. First, your opening premise was that you don't think that applications are actually, they have no choice, they have to go back to the developer to process your GPS. If I'm a big company that makes money from exploiting users' privacy, do you think they agree with that take? Or do you think they, in other words, do you think they actually do want you to come back to their, so they can do tracking like we saw?
That's a very good question. So this tool that our system is being used by what, two applications on one phone, all of it is in my pocket. Deploying this is incredibly hard, even if application developers want it, even if they're good, because I don't think Google, Apple, or not an official word, but even Microsoft, would actually build out the system because, I mean, they want that data, right? That's a problem. So we actually organized a workshop last year that tried to bring industry people in, regulators in, and academics in, to talk about privacy, how exactly to move this forward. And what was surprising to at least me was that even the regulators' point is that they don't want this sort of provable, guaranteed privacy because they don't want to force these big companies, Google, Microsoft, into actually doing this because the companies wouldn't. Right, so even the regulators have this sort of light touch. We will nudge, wink, wink on things that we like. So the only thing that everyone could agree on was providing users more transparency and more control. The companies still want to be able to gather all the data they're gathering today, but they just want to legitimize it by providing users transparency and control. And at some level, that's better than what we have. So maybe that's sort of the next step. So now coming back to how this fits into COI, I mean, we did this before we sort of got this feedback from industry, but being able to raise this level of abstraction helps even there. So today, if you look at your iPhone, what it says is that, yes, such and such application used your GPS hardware, but you have no idea what it did with that information. At the very least, by exposing the triggers that these applications are setting, the user can say, oh, my reminders application set a trigger at a grocery store. I know why it did that because I told it that I wanted to buy milk. I can sort of see that. Versus, why did my reminder application just set a trigger at the nearest shopping center? I didn't do anything about that, right? So just providing this information to the user might be useful. So if you think about this stuff, COI as two separate components, right? The abstraction that we provide and the backend privacy cloud service, I wouldn't bet on the cloud service part. But the abstraction part I would bet on, because that then gives users more information about what's happening. And so coming back to your question, would these companies like this or not, they won't like the privacy part, but they would like the transparency and control part.
Okay, quickly, my second question is, so I was kind of on board with everything with the abstraction, and then you went to the cloud. Is this assuming that the user doesn't trust the OS? Because why can't we do most of this matching in my phone's OS and not involve the cloud at all?
Well, because the phone's OS is in the same position as the app developer in the sense that it doesn't have the entire world database about all points of interest on the phone itself. It has to eventually go to the cloud to get that information. So when you register a trigger at Safeway.
But in the case of matching, say, my current location anywhere within 5 blocks, so some application just places that in my OS, a tag saying, this application wants to know when you get within 5 blocks, then the OS could you know, go through.
Right, so the application can say I'm looking for a grocery store within 5 blocks. The OS doesn't know where the grocery stores are. And so the OS has to go to the cloud to get those grocery stores. And this is one way of doing it. There might be other ways of getting that in a secure, private manner, but that's something that we can talk about offline.
Okay, thanks.
Brian Ford, Yale University. Very nice work.
Thanks.
So this is kind of a tinfoil hat kind of question, but I'm wondering how much you've thought into putting into, you know, how hard it would be to strengthen the design so it would even work, you know, even, or like, what if the combiner and matcher do collude, or what if the combiner or matcher, great, backup slide, but what if the combiner or matcher can inject malicious queries,
right,
or tags, or
right, so
stuff like
so
that.
Two things, one is collusion, one is malicious queries. So collusion between the commander and manager, we can't do anything, right? The information that we put is in two places, the two of them combined, we're done. One thing we could do is maybe have multiple combiners, so you need some threshold of them to agree on. It's going to make the protocol more and more complicated, and we didn't go that way. The way we did collusion was we said, let's, like it came up earlier today, let's look at sort of a policy approach to dissuading collusion, right? So we said, okay, we'll allow these privacy advocates, antivirus companies, certificate agencies, nonprofits to run the combiner, right? The entire existence of these companies is premised on public trust. Sure, you might collude. Someday it'll come out, like it did for that Norwegian certificate agency, or was it Belgian certificate agency, right? Whistleblowers or something, it'll someday come out. Once it does, your entire business is scrapped, right? So DigiNotar, where the certificate agency was issuing bad certificates, went out of business overnight, right? So you have a strong incentive to not collude when your entire existence relies on public trust. So that's on the combiner side. On the matcher side, we said that we will allow the user to pick the combiner, right? So you can't find a combiner that would like to collude with you and put him in place, because the user gets to pick the combiner. And there might be hundreds of these things. Right now, if you really want to violate privacy, now you have to collude with a significant fraction of those, and that's going to come out very quickly. And once that does, then again, you have the PR nightmare to deal with, that you're now explicitly circumventing privacy-preserving technology, and that you might even be liable legally for. So that's how we do collusion. Now, when it comes to malicious combiners or malicious matchers, we actually got proofs for two of these things. I forget which two, where even a malicious combiner or malicious matcher could not violate user privacy. The third one, ProVerif, did not terminate to the best of our efforts to make it terminate. So that might still work. We don't have a proof for it yet.
Thanks.
Quick answer.
Yeah. Marcelo Martins, Brown University. You said you're providing new API for developers. From the client point of view, what would you say about the communication overhead or energy overhead if the client is, or the user is concerned about his, let's say, has a limited data plan or a battery state itself? Could you elaborate a little bit about it?
I'm not sure I got the question because of the answer. Oh, limited bandwidth energies. Yes, actually, talk to me afterwards. We actually have numbers that say that we can actually reduce energy costs just because we can amortize. Because the OS has all this information, right? It can amortize across all your background running apps. And so we actually save bandwidth, save energy-wise as well as bandwidth-wise if you were to do this, as long as you do that correctly. But yeah, talk to me afterwards for the
thank
numbers.
You.
Let's thank Saikat. I have